Now, I don't know how the stock was publicized. Do you know what the title given to the stock? Anyone?
Yes, well, Egypt at the crossroads.
Egypt at the crossroads. Very good. So I have to keep flipping my notebook to see something that would fit. Well, we were all probably gripped by the events in Egypt in the last 2 months. It was the height of what will become known as the flower revolutions in the Middle East or in the Arab world, having come 1 month after the Jasmine Revolution in Tunisia, the Egyptian Revolution that started on the 25th of January was given different names. One of them is the Lotus Revolution. Lotus is a flower that appears on the in many of the walls of ancient Egyptian temples. So Lotus Revolution for now. So if I use the word Lotus Revolution, then the reference is to this revolution that galvanized the imagination of everybody around the world, including, you know, American presidents, British Prime Minister, French President. Everybody praised Egyptian youngsters for having staged that revolution. And partly because it was a peaceful revolution. Massive, but peaceful. And the only violence used during that revolution was actually violence meted by the regime itself, by President Mubarak's regime. But other than that, the revolution was orderly, peaceful, and it resonated not only in the immediate environment around Egypt and other countries of the Middle East. 5 countries have been influenced directly by that revolution in terms of method, in terms of language, in terms of strategy and tactics. One in Bahrain, one in Jordan, one in Yemen, and one that's unfortunately not as peaceful in Libya. So that is why the event, pardon?
Syria.
And Syria. Syria. Yes. In both Syria and Libya, and I will come to that in a minute, unfortunately was met by massive regime brutal reactions. And this has something to do with the protracted dictatorship in both countries. In Libya, the Gaddafi has been in power for 42 years. In Syria, between the present president, Bashar, and his father, Hafez al-Assad, together they have been ruling Syria for 52 years. So, two-thirds of Syrian history as an independent country and two-thirds of Libyan history as an independent country was ruled by the same figure or the same family. And that's why it is very hard for them to give up power, and that's why they are determined to fight to the end. This is just on our neighbors. But believe it or not, the Egyptian revolution of the 25th of January, which I'm calling for the purpose of this talk, the Lotus Revolution, has resonated in as far places as Madison, Wisconsin. Those of you who have watched the uprising against the governor, they were carrying signs telling fellow Wisconsinians to fight like Egyptians, to be determined to carry on, to persist. And on the other side of the world, in Beijing, in China. Again, youngsters in China, probably the children of the Tiananmen Square martyrs, people who were run over by tanks some 2 decades ago, their children also staged certain uprisings in different cities of China, upholding the Egyptian revolution as a role model, try to be peaceful but to persist. Now, the communist regime in China is like the Assad regime in Syria and the Libyan regime in Libyan regime. I don't think they will give in that easily, as they did probably in Tiananmen Square. They will not hesitate to do the same thing with young Chinese. All right, this is as far as the resonance of the Egyptian revolution of the 25th of January 2011. Now I have to work back and then come forward to the issue that probably is of great interest to you, and that is the future of the peace process or the peace situation in the Middle East with all of these uprisings, with all of these revolutions. That I'm going to keep to the end in order to keep you here. But in my notes, I start, the title of this talk, Better Late Than Never. Better Late Than Never. A phrase that we learned when we were youngsters, still in the romantic phase, always trying to fall in love, even late in life, and we say, better late than never. With democracy, we say the same thing. I say the same thing about the Middle East, about the Arab world, about Egypt. Better late than never. Why did I choose this title? Because shortly after 9/11, there were an avalanche of writings about the Arab world, about the Muslim world, talking about how exceptional that part of the world is in terms of its immunity to democracy. We had famous writers like Bernard Lewis, for example, my colleague at Princeton, who's just finishing his book, celebrate his 93rd birthday. But he has been a great scholar of the Middle East and of the Arab world. Well, at one time, he wrote, shortly around 9/11, a book called What Went Wrong, trying to explain why 19 out of the 22 who staged 9/11 came from the Arab world. And he's trying to explain why this is the case. He was also joined in this respect by two others, also very famous scholars. One is Fukuyama, Francis Fukuyama. You remember that name? The End of History? Yes. And Samuel Huntington. Samuel Huntington, a political scientist at Harvard, wrote also many books, but one of them is the basically The Clash of Civilization, in which he made a proposition again, saying that even though the end of the Cold War, but there is still some big global conflict, and that is the clash of civilization, and the clash will be between the Western civilization and two other civilizations. One is the Muslim civilization, or Islamic civilization, and the other one is a Chinese culture, Chinese civilization, if you wish. And in all of these propositions, Bernard Lewis, Fukuyama, and Huntington, there is always that assertion that somehow the Muslims or the Arabs are immune to democracy, immune to pluralism, immune to the kind of values that made the West what it is. Well, that proposition remained unchallenged, except by people like myself, for a long time. And here, with all of these uprisings in the Middle East, clamoring for democracy, I say it is not me, the scholar, who is debating another scholar, but it is the masses, it is the young generation of Arabs, of Middle Easterners, who are challenging Fukuyama, challenging Huntington, challenging Bernard Lewis. It is history in the making in our part of the world. And what do they asking for? As one, some of you, two or three of you, noted that the people that they saw in the streets, in Tahrir Square, a big square in the center of Cairo. How many of you have been to Cairo? Very good. So you remember what Tahrir Square is. That's where Hilton, Semiramis, and all of the great hotels are around, very close to Tahrir Square. Well, what people saw in Tahrir Square, what CNN and BBC and Al Jazeera showed us every night, people who spoke English, people who looked middle class, people, boys and girls, who were just like boys and girls here on any American campus. And therefore that revolution, a middle class revolution, was not necessarily asking for bread. They were asking for freedom, for democracy. And they were not in the hundreds when I started, you know, a human rights movement, a democracy movement, some 30 years ago. I was dancing alone, literally dancing alone. There were very few people who would echo my appeal, who would echo my call for freedom and democracy. Not because they did not exist. I'm sure now that they always existed, but they lived in a culture of fear, and therefore they will not speak out. What we saw in Tahrir Square is a generation that seemed to have broken the fear barrier and were able to assert themselves and to feel strong enough about their conviction, that were willing to take whatever or to make whatever sacrifice that was needed. So what does this all mean? Is it something that is alien or totally new in the Middle East or in Egypt? And my answer is no. Egypt had known democracy. Believe it or not, back in 1860, I'm watching a series on the Civil War in America, and 1860, America was still in the height of trying to redefine itself. Germany had not united yet. Italy had not a country yet. So Egypt, back in 1860, had its first experiment with democracy. Granted, it was not a Westminster robust democracy. It was not congressional or American-style democracy. But for a third world country, for a country in Africa, for a country in the Middle East, this was way ahead of its time. And the story has it We had a very visionary ruler at the time by the name of Ishmael. Ishmael, Abraham, these are all biblical names. His name was Ishmael. And Ishmael received his early education in France and Italy, was fascinated by what he saw in Europe. So when he became ruler of Egypt, he wanted to modernize Egypt. And his understanding of modernity was a bit shallow, naive, but interesting. The folklore, the political folklore, is that he had a crush on Empress Eugenie of France. And he wanted to invite her to Egypt. And preferably without her husband. It was during his reign that the Suez Canal was to be opened. So in preparation for opening the Suez Canal, he created all kind of modern palaces, amenities, public parks, bridges, paved roads, and among other things, he built an opera house, discovered that there is no opera composers in Egypt at the time. So guess what he did? Exactly. He commissioned Verdi, an Italian composer, who composed Aida, which is still living with us. This was that ruler of Egypt back in the 1850s and 1860s. Well, after he did all of this, what I would consider probably shallow trappings of modernity, somebody said, but you don't have a parliament. He said, a parliament. Let's have a parliament.
Parliament.
Democracy. You don't have democracy in this country. So he issued a decree to start preparing for democratic governance, and had an election, and had a deputies elected for that new parliament, and he got a veteran Egyptian public figure who had also spent several years in Europe, knows what democracy is, what parliamentary life is like, and Sharif Pasha, his name was Sharif Pasha, was advising, orienting the newly elected representatives on what democracy is all about. And among other things, he said, you know, the traditions in democratic countries and in parliaments in the West is that the loyalist, the supporters of the government sit on the right and the opposition sits on the left. And he was just using his arms, his hands, to make the point. So the people sitting on the left rushed to the right, disclaiming that there could be opposition. How could we oppose our master? The idea of opposing a ruler was so alien at the time. Well, that very parliament, 10 years later, will stage a coup against the ruler. The ones who did not dare even the thought of opposing. When the ruler kept, you know, trying to pass decrees, to raise taxes, one of them remembered, no taxation without representation. So during those 10 years, they went, studied other systems, other parliaments, what happened in other countries, and they came on the slogan, no representation, no taxation without representation. So I think it was the third or the fourth tax that he wanted to impose. So the apartment said no.
Want some water?
And that was the beginning of a revolt against that ruler, called the Urabi Revolt in 1981. A revolt that he could not suppress, so he called on the British to come and save him. And that was the British occupation of Egypt that started in 1882 and would last until 1952. So that is a background that shows that both democracy and liberal ideas are not that strange, are not that alien. They began slowly but surely throughout at least a century and a half. And that's why several of you, before we started this formal presentation, asking me, are you optimistic? And I was teasing the gentleman on my left, who should rush to the right. And just to be facetious, I said, no, I'm not optimistic. You think, do you think it will be a war? I said, yes, it'll be a war. Now you know I was facetious, and I don't think there'll be a war, not between the Arabs and the Israelis, not between Egypt and Israel. This is the last part of my talk, is the future of the peace process. But even before I get to that, I wanted to say three or four more things. One is the stages in between. We have had mass uprisings. So what you saw last month is not unique to Egypt. We had a similar uprising, late 19th century, the Urabi Revolt in 1880, 81, 82. We had another massive uprising in 1919 against the British occupation. And then we had one in mid-century in 1952, that is the Nasser Revolt. And then this last one that you saw last month. So the idea of revolting against a status quo, against the system, against the regime, against power that be, whether it is domestic rulers, tyranny, or foreign occupation, is not new to the Egyptians. And if we want to go beyond Egypt, I would say not new to the Middle East, or to the Arab world either. There were similar revolutions elsewhere in the Arab world. So if you, any country you can pick, at least in the northern tier of the Arab world, the countries around the Mediterranean, countries that were affected by what was happening in Europe. When Napoleon came to Egypt in 1798, and many people think of that early incursion from Europe in the Middle East or in Egypt as a military campaign. To us, social scientists who go beyond the surface, I think the most important thing of that Napoleonic invasion of Egypt, or conquest of Egypt, was two things. He brought with him a press, printing press, and also a group of scholars, scholars who discovered the Rosetta Stone and deciphered or decoded the ancient Egyptian language, the hieroglyphic language, and therefore discovered much of the history of Egypt was not known to the Egyptians themselves. So that, to my mind, was probably the most important contribution of that French expedition in the late 18th century, early 19th century. From that time on, the progress toward liberal values, toward modern values, began and proceeded steadily since then. And therefore, what the youngsters in Tahrir Square, which is becoming now a very famous household word, Tahrir Square, in the center of Cairo, was echoed, first of all, in other major Egyptian cities. Second, in the neighboring countries. Third, in Madison, Wisconsin, and Beijing, China. The question is, what would be, first, the future of Egypt, two, how that is going to impact on the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty. Surprisingly, any of you who watch it, CNN coverage of the events of that revolution in Tahrir Square, and I will testify to, I took a leave from my students at Drew University for 2 weeks, or 1 week, whatever it was, to go in the middle of that revolution, to see it, to participate. Or more accurately, for historical sake, my wife summoned me. I was eager to go, but my wife, who had remained in Egypt, an American, and who spoke to the crowds in Tahrir Square, and when the crowds asked, "Where is your husband? Where is your husband?" she promised that she will bring me next time she comes to Tahrir Square. And rightly so. She summoned me to go back to Egypt, and we went from the airport directly to Tahrir Square. Other than seeing this history in the making, I was very curious to see the kind of slogans, vocabulary, chanting they had. Until I left Egypt in exile several years ago, whenever a crowd like that gathered in any public square, there were two or three themes for their protest. One would be probably against this or that policy of the regime, one against America, and one theme anti-Israeli. So the anti-Israeli industry was a growth industry all over the Middle East. Still probably a growth industry. However, when I went to Tahrir Square on the 11th of January, I did not see a single sign anti-Israeli or anti-Zionist or anti-American. People were very focused on getting rid of the regime, a tyrannical regime to many of them, corrupt regime, decadent. So this was really their focus. And in some ways, it was heartening to see that young Egyptians, unlike probably three generations before them, are not fixated on anti-Western or anti-Israeli policies, but rather wanting a better life, a better society for themselves. Does this mean there is no anti-Israeli sentiment? No, I'm sure there is some of it. But it is not as much in vogue as it used to be, at least for the time being. And I had maintained that this is always the case, since the peace treaty, or since Camp David, since the historic visit of Sadat to Israel, until Israel does something stupid or something brutal, then the anti-Israeli sentiment rises again. And I said that, by the way, inside Israel. I visited Israel 4 times, two of which was my students from the American University in Cairo, to see for themselves what the Israeli society is like. I had visited alone 2 times before. The 3rd time was my students, and the 4th time also was my students. And the people were very curious to know what Israel is like. And in that respect, I told the Israelis whatever I just said here, is that so long as they at least show moderation and willingness to rectify some of the historical wrongs committed vis-a-vis the Palestinians or vis-a-vis their neighbors, so long as they continue to do that, more and more people will be won to the peace camp in the Middle East. And I still believe that. In several of the interviews I had during the events of last month and some of the public lectures, whenever there are people who are interested in the future of Israel, whenever they raise that question, I would give them the answer I just gave you, is that the region is in no mood for going back to war. It may not be in the mood for going all the way to peace, but the idea of war on a large scale is no longer in vogue in the Middle East. People are more focused on either their own immediate country or in trying to be part of the 21st century and to forge constructive relations with Europe and the West. There is something that I always, especially since 9/11, whenever I was asked, why do people hate us? I said, I don't know whether people hate you or not, but as a sociologist, as a political sociologist, I always look for empirical tests. And there is a simple test I call the embassy visa test. Go around Cairo or Beirut or Rabat in Morocco. See where the longest line is in front of any embassy. Invariably, it is in front of the American embassy. Everybody wants to come to America, either to study, or for medical treatment, or for business, or entertainment. So that is America. You go around the Middle East, there used to be 2 American universities in the Middle East for a long time, for the last 200 years. One in Beirut, called the AUB, American University in Beirut, and one in Cairo, called the AUC, American University in Cairo. Between 9/11 and today, meaning in the last 10 years, 55 more American universities, 55 now. So now we have close to 60 American universities all over the Middle East. And I'm taking education here, since I am speaking to a group of intellectually inclined audience, but on a more superficial way, Starbucks, is everywhere in the Middle East. So all the fast food chain, so both American education, American way of life, are very popular with Middle Easterners, Egyptians included, of course, and the rest. Even those of you who go to Israel and cross the West Bank will find the same thing. Even those Palestinians, all their grievances vis-a-vis Israel, vis-a-vis America that supports Israel, will find the same way. That American education is in high demand. American lifestyle is in high demand. And with these two things in vogue, I'm not worried about the region going back to a belligerent or a war course. Having said all of that, I prevail on all of you to keep an active interest, which you already have, but probably more confined and more focused on Israel. But for God's sake and for regional peace, expand your focus to beyond Israel, and especially to Egypt. Egypt is a central country, a pivotal country, and one thing you can do is to help democracy succeed in Egypt, or resucceed in Egypt. And one way of doing that is not only to keep an active interest, but to write to your congressman, to your senator, to President Obama, to lend a hand. And one way of doing so is through debt forgiveness, because there is a huge debt that Egypt is carrying on its back vis-a-vis both international institutions like the World Bank, IMF, and other creditors, and also vis-a-vis the United States. At least the U.S. could and should, in my opinion, forgive that debt, and to do so probably to make it conditional. And here is really the twist. So my wife asked me this morning before I came here to emphasize, is to make the forgiveness of that debt conditional on continuing the democratic course in Egypt. In other words, with every step forward toward democracy, there will be a reduction of $2 or $3 billion of that debt. As you know, debt to third world countries is hardly collectible. So anyhow, make it a favor by saying you will forgive Egypt from that debt, but contingent on staying the course of democratic transformation in the country. And with that recommendation, and your recommendation that will support me to monitor the elections in Egypt, I conclude my presentation and open the floor for
dialogue. One thing that you said initially, that you were going to tell us your expectation about the role of the brotherhood in the Egyptian future. But somehow you forgot to mention that.
The Muslim Brotherhood.
If I
forgot to mention them, it is because they came late to the revolution, by the way. The revolution started on the 25th of January. The young Muslim brothers, not the leadership of the Muslim brothers, came to the revolution on the 29th of January. So they were late comers to the revolution. They occupied a corner in Tahrir Square. You probably saw a group in Tahrir Square on Friday praying. Does anyone recall that scene? Usually midday on Friday there is a collective prayer. And so they made a point, of course, as Muslim brothers, even though they are young, that they will pay, that they will conduct the Friday sermon and prayer midday. And part of the ecumenical nature of that 25th of January revolution, the Lotus Revolution, is that the people who made a cordon emptied part of the square for them to have this collective prayer were Christian youngsters. In Egypt, we have 10% Christians called the Copts. And was young boys and girls, Coptic boys and girls, you could see that from the crosses that they were wearing. They are the ones who emptied a big space in one corner for them to conduct their Friday prayer. Another interesting element is that they had a platform. Tahrir Square is a huge space. And there were four platforms for people to give speeches. And the Muslim Brother had one of the corners. In other words, they made up something like 20% of the crowd in Tahrir Square. But as a mark, either public relation ploy or genuine, when they recognized my wife, an American, she was wearing on her back, on her front, big thing with my pictures on it behind bars. I was in prison and a lot of pictures in the media with me in prison were circulating. So she got one of those, enlarged it, and wore it during the protest. So many of them recognized her immediately and asked the Muslim brothers, asked her, even though her Arabic is not a very fluent Arabic, but kind of a working Arabic, an Arabic that's similar to Milanese Arabic. They asked her to address the public, and she did. And of course, in these kind of occasions, it doesn't matter what you're saying. People look, every two or three phrases, they will applaud her. She will greet people. I'm saying that because the Muslim brothers, the young Muslim brothers, wanted to project a new image. An image that, one, they cooperate with others. Because they had that one corner out of four corners in the square. There were four platforms. Two, even though they were latecomers, but they proved to be street fighters. Street fighters. Some of you may recall that the regime tried to disperse the demonstrators. And first they tried low-flying aircraft over the square, breaking the sound barrier, sonic boom, trying to scare everybody in the square. Well, the young people in the square were not scared. They persisted. So they tried the second thing, and that is horses and horsemen charge, the horses and the camels came later in that sequence. So first, aeroplanes, second, trucks, vehicles, driving at full speed in the square, over many people were, actually many of the casualties of that revolution was a result of these trucks charging into the square, several trucks of these. But still the young people did not, were not scared, and they continued. And then the third was the horseman, and then the camelman. Now, with the horseman and the camelman, the Muslim brothers in the square are the ones who are able to confront these horsemen and those camelmen by bringing them from down and do it battling with them. So the role of the Muslim brothers in the immediate events of the Lotus Revolution, even though they came late, but they were cooperating with everybody. Two, they were street fighters when it came to fighting, and they protected the back of the rest of the youngsters in the square. Now, what had happened since then, and the future? One, they never had a political party, the Muslim Brothers. If they ran for election, they ran incognito, behind somebody else. One of the early things when the revolution happened is to allow whoever wants to form a political party to form it. So the Muslim Brothers, for 80 years without a party, took advantage of that opening, and they declared a party of their own. Now, are they going to run for the presidency? We have two elections coming, the ones that we're going to fund. One for the parliament and one for the presidency. They said they will run for the parliament, the People's Assembly, and they hope to garner 30% of the seats. In the last parliament, they had 10%. Now, they think they could have 30%. Could they have more? I doubt it. That is their strength with the populace. We ran in my center, Ibn Khaldun Center, public opinion polling every now and then, and we know that their support, for those who answer the question, is about 23% in the population at large. But given the fact that they are better organized and better funded, they probably can raise that percentage from 23% to 30% of the voters. What would they do? Interestingly enough, they have not spoken of the Sharia law. I know many lawyers here. Sharia law is the Islamic-based law and that emerged from the second Islamic century on. Even though originally that was a central demand among the founders of the Muslim Brothers back in 1928, after the fall of the Caliphate in Istanbul, yet during the event of the revolution they did not raise that slogan, the Sharia law slogan. Have they given it up? I don't think so. But they know that it will turn off many voters, and therefore they are not very vocal about it now. More accurately, I think, they are taking their clue, if you are following events in the Middle East, they are taking their clue from Turkey. There is a party in power in Turkey called the Justice and Development Party, AKP, abbreviation. And AKP, even though Islamic-based, yet it did not insist on applying Sharia law. You, how many of you have been to Turkey? Oh, you make a package, you go to Turkey and Egypt, same number of hands. You go to Turkey, you don't know that an Islamic-oriented political party is in power. The nightclubs are still there. The McDonald's are still there, just like in Egypt. Starbucks are there. The lifestyle has not really changed much in Turkey.
Some of the press isn't there anymore.
It's changed.
Well, I'm just telling you, at least I taught for 1 year in Turkey under the AKP in Istanbul.
It's escalating in the last year.
Sure, maybe. It doesn't surprise me, but if they are doing it, they are doing it in a very subtle way, in a way that will not antagonize the military.
I respectfully disagree.
Yeah, that's fine. Anyhow, that is probably the closest analogy that I can give about the future of the Muslim Brothers. Would they win an election free and fair? No, I don't think so. But they will be a significant bloc, and probably in coalition with others, they will be definitely participating in the government. Are you going to recognize people? Do you know all the names?
No, I don't know. They laid down the end. Okay.
Thank you very much for your talk. I went to a talk this afternoon which predicted there will never be democracy for many years in Egypt because, number one, the number of women who were circumcised is something like 90%. The illiteracy rate is astronomical. You should not mention Karadali in the speech that he gave, which was vehemently anti-Semitic, anti-Israel, wanting to get rid of the peace treaty. He had great money, people listening. And I also want to mention that I had a conversation with a young woman about a year ago, a student here. And this is what I fear is true of many, many liberal arts students from Egypt and other Muslim Arab countries. And I asked her after the talk that was given, do you want to see a theocracy in Egypt? And she said, absolutely. And I said, well...
To see what?
Theocracy. And she said, absolutely. Now, these are people who come here. I know the lines are very long in front of the embassies to come to the United States, but I feel that a vast number of students going through liberal education did not have the first clue about what democracy really is, about separation of church and state, and all the things that make the West the West. And maybe you could comment on some of those. And also, one of the first things they did was allow the ships from Iran passed through the Suez. They're definitely moving closer to Iran. That does not bode well for democracy.
Going to take more questions?
Yeah, I'm going to take more questions.
I think one at a time.
One at a time. I usually...
Are you going to answer the lady's question?
I will.
Oh,
of course.
Yeah, well,
but usually it takes a long time in answering.
I'm afraid all the questions now and then you answer everybody?
Yeah. All
whatever you want, you're in charge.
Every three or four.
Oh, okay.
All right, let's jump. I'll add a little bit to Judy's question. So we have the narrative of the Lotus Revolution. I hadn't heard that term before. It's a lovely term. Of these modern and nonviolent and cooperative young Democrats who also cleaned up after themselves in this great chaos.
Yes, right? So
all right, so to that narrative, let me add two incidents, and I'd like to know if you think they're just total outliers or how they affect the narrative. One is Karadari's speech, which had a million people showed up. Secondly is the gang rape of Lara Logan to the chant of Jew, Jew, Jew in Tahrir Square. So are these the same Democrats? Are these different Democrats? Are these phony Democrats? So just how does that affect the narrative?
Right,
secondly, just getting to the opening with Iran and Turkey, the Egyptian foreign minister made a speech in the last few days in which he said, basically he was echoing the Turkish, the first move the Turks made towards opening up towards changing their Western orientation, which said, we want to be open with all, everyone in our area. It's called constructive engagement, including Iran. So they essentially root themselves from the Western bloc and put themselves more open to working with Iran. Thank you.
I'm just going to add on that. That is, you know, it's like one vote, one person, one time. And to go back to what you were speaking about, Turkey, Erdogan and his prime minister, I mean, they have emasculated their army. And in that parallel, the army for the last, 40 years has been also the protector in Egypt. So there's, could be a parallel going on there if that were to happen in a religious party comes to fore. You also haven't mentioned the Salafi and where do they stand? So, how do you say Salafi? Not Salami, Salafi. Anyway, so you could comment on that. And then about the vitriolic, you know, whether it's Zionism or anti-Israel or plain old, you know, historical anti-Semitism. You saw plenty of pictures of Mubarak with, you know, the devil's face and the Jewish star all over the demonstration. So there's, you know, I don't know if that's anti-peace agreement or just anti Jews, or and under Mubarak's time, also there was so much of a controlled media was vitriolic anti-Semitism, which is also going on in Turkey.
Yeah.
Well, let me just say, but I just want to finish that up. This is a little bit more nuanced than what I'm hearing you talk about, but that's what I'd like to hear you comment on.
Yeah. Actually, to addendum on the Turkey, Erdogan and Gül also gutted the judiciary. Let's not forget that, because now the Supreme Court is totally Islamist, which means they do have Sharia, whether you see it immediately or not. Secondly, I am very concerned, of course, about Qaradawi, but also about Halawi. Now, I saw him on TV a couple of days ago, and he said, yes, of course we want the Sharia. Not right away, but that's what we're going to have. No doubt about it, he said. This is our goal, and that's what we're going to have. Now, I've seen polls that say something like 60 to 70% of the men, I guess, and women in Egypt and a lot of other countries in the Middle East also do want Sharia. They do support suicide bombing. They do want to break the peace with Israel. And the percentages are very high. They vary. But it's from 50% to 70% to 80% depending on the question. So I don't understand where your optimism is coming from.
Excuse me. Now we want to keep asking more questions.
Excuse me.
If I may just say one thing. Yeah. Nassim Rim is going to have a ride back to his home at 7 o'clock, so I would give him an opportunity to answer and then perhaps.
So he's going to have to leave.
I just would add this into the mix because I'm a little worried. You are an educated man, you are a broad man. You say it'll be okay with Israel if they don't do anything foolish or stupid. Israel. Gaza, Hamas, Gaza. If Israel doesn't do anything stupid, how do you imagine that they will not be able to contain themselves if they are continually bombarded? And if you would call that stupid, then we're in a whole lot of trouble.
Good. Let me start with my optimism. My wife has a definition of an optimist. My wife has a definition of an optimist. He is the one who is married to a pessimist. Pessimist. An optimist is someone who is married to a pessimist. I am an optimist, like you. Did you say yourself?
No.
No. Who is an optimist here?
I'm an optimist.
Three are around me. That's why I am an optimist. Yeah. These are my colleagues at Drew. Now, that is a source of my optimism. What, seeing that revolution in my lifetime...
You have to be realistic, too. Yeah.
In my lifetime, a revolution for democracy, something I've been fighting for the last 40 years. I'm speaking about my own experience. I went to prison because of that. So if anyone is to be a bit doubtful, pessimist, somebody who, you know, I'm like Sharansky. Natan Sharansky is a good friend of mine. And he is one of the Israelis who invited me to his center in Israel. He went to prison. So when you go to prison for principal Natan Sharansky, you are entitled to be a pessimist, but I'm not, because I saw things changing in my own lifetime. I was here as a student in the 60s. Much of my activism was actually acquired during the anti-Vietnam War, the civil rights movement, the freedom rights in the South. Having seen these things in my own lifetime, and anyone who's over 65 probably would remember those years, well, we have come a long way in all fronts. So if you don't look at the very short run, if you look at the longer haul, you see what happened in Europe, the fall of communism, and before that the fall of fascism, the advance of democracy from Portugal in 1974. 80 countries have moved from non-democratic rule all over the world to democratic rule. When you see that in your lifetime, I can, if I insist on being a pessimist, then I deserve it, and I deserve to live depressed the rest of my life. But I'm not. I am determined to carry on my optimism. If you are an activist, and I don't know how many of you are activists, if you have been to the streets fighting, you can never be a pessimist. You have to be an optimist. Because you believe in change, you believe you are capable, as an agent, human agent, of contributing to bringing about change. And I have seen that, and I have done it, both here in America in the 60s as a young student, and back home. I have seen things happening in my region. We haven't had a major war in the Middle East, at least between the two countries that have always had wars, between 1948 and 1973. Well, that was, what, between 1948 and 1973, about 25 years. Well, the longer part of the history of Israel, there hasn't been a war with Egypt. There hasn't been a war with Syria. There haven't been a major war between states in the region. These skirmishes with guerrillas here and there, yes. But wars with states, with planes, with tanks, no, we haven't. So why can't I be entitled to be an optimist about the future? Turkey and the army. Interestingly enough, the Turkish leadership was very eager to get to Egypt during the revolution, either to advise or to consult or whatever. I don't know exactly what happened behind closed doors. They did not meet with officials. They only met with the crowds in Tahrir Square. I hope that they give advice to the Muslim brothers not to overplay their cards. Because if they play their cards, there was somebody like them in Turkey. Before Erdogan, there was somebody by the name of Erbakan. And the reason why Erdogan broke with Erbakan is that Erbakan was the old style Islamicist, like the Muslim brothers, more or less. So I think his advice was, go the democratic route. Whatever you want to do, try to do it democratically. And that is basically what he's doing in Turkey. Whether you agree with him or not, at least he has avoided the usually 20-year cycle of coup d'etats. The military used to come to power every 20 years from 1951 or 52. All the way down to the time that Erbakan was elected. So, but that has not happened. In the last 20 years, it has not happened. So obviously he was giving them an advice based on his own experience as a mayor of a small town, then as a mayor of a large city, then as a prime minister, is that to go about whatever agenda they have peacefully. And I don't care whether the Muslim brothers wanted to apply Sharia or not. Even if they want to apply Sharia, so long as they are doing it democratically, after they have a majority, after they get elected, which brings me to a question that was given by one of the ladies about the one man, one vote, one time. Where has that happened in the Muslim world? Iran. Give me one case.
Gaza. In Iran.
Gaza. Wait a minute, wait a minute. Have they refused to have elections?
No.
I have a phony election, you might as well not have an election.
Wait a minute. We are getting now into a thin area.
Gaza, now, there's no election in Gaza.
Iranians stole the election. Excuse me.
They stole it?
Yeah, back in 09, May 09.
They may have, I don't know. I'm asking,
Well, there's three.
What? They stole the election.
Well, no.
Testified by who?
Fatah.
Which one stole the election?
Listen. Iran.
Yes, I agree with Iran, but
okay.
These guys did not come to power elected. Did the Khomeini came to power by democratic vote?
No.
This was a revolution.
Oh, all right.
No. Wait a minute.
If
we have a collective anxiety around this table, I can't help it.
Iran just said watching.
Collective anxiety. Collective anxiety meaning, if you don't have a Democrat in Egypt, you say we cannot find that partner. If you have a Democrat,
you're changing the subject every second.
No, I'm saying.
It sounds like you are. Maybe try to make yourself a little more clear.
One man, one vote. I'm asking where has happened.
Elected in Gaza, right?
Did they refuse to have another election?
They didn't have an election.
The question is,
they didn't have a free democratic election in Gaza.
What can I say? I cannot answer that. I'm saying, where has it happened in a Muslim majority country?
In the West Bank, where there's been another election. How many elections did Saddam Hussein win? Amazing, by such amazing votes.
Is that your model, Saddam Hussein? Did I mention him in the lecture?
The Palestinians, yes, they don't have elections.
They had elections.
Saddam Hussein? Are we going to discuss Saddam Hussein here? Who's changing the subject now? Who is changing the subject? When you bring Saddam Hussein, when you bring this and that, I'm saying, tell me, you have Indonesia as a majority Muslim country. You have Malaysia. You have Turkey. You have Senegal. You have Nigeria. You have many countries that are majority Muslim countries. And Islamic parties lost one, but they vacated power. Okay. They rotated power.
Good.
Isn't that what democracy is?
Yes, yes. You ask for other examples.
Democracy is defined in many ways. You have to have freedom of the press. You have to have a rule of law.
Fully agree.
And you have to have all these elements. So democracy is defined by many different standards. I don't know that democracy in this country equates to democracy that you see in your country. I give you a lot of credit for surviving in prison and the light that now shines to you. But let's face it, the army has controlled the situation in Egypt. They control the peace between Israel and in Egypt. They represent today a fraction of the budget of the overall economy of Egypt versus when they were in war with Israel, it was 25% to 30%. As long as they're strong and they can, in fact, prevail in terms of many of the things, it's not democracy, but it is a stability. I'm wondering also how much of this is economic. You know, the people in the middle class in Egypt have suffered tremendously. And we wonder whether they are really looking for freedom or whether they are looking for jobs that would free them in terms of their way of life. But in Turkey, you have a very slanted view of what is democracy, because there is no democracy in Turkey today. There is election, true. But they are controlling everything. Not only have they flipped the wings of the army, they flipped the Justice Department, they equipped
the press as well.
The press, and everything that would constitute in this country a democracy. You see, we have a tremendous amount of debate in this country. You don't have it in those countries because it is controlled by the government. If you go to Turkey and you have the least bit of trail of a democracy or a freedom fighter, you are trailed by the secret police. Your room is bugged. They know everything that you do. So it is hardly a good country.
So, and the your conclusion?
I hope that Egypt survives this situation. I think economically, they'd be foolish to disturb the peace treaty with Israel, because economically it's to their advantage. The zones that are duty-free are a tremendous advantage. But don't misunderstand the Muslim Brotherhood. They are very clever. They are underneath the surface. And if they have their way, that country is going to go up the storm. And this is what we worry about the entire Middle East today. In those areas that have been, although dictators, they have been secular in their makeup.
Conclusion? You prefer secular, stable dictatorships?
No.
No. I'm trying to conclude.
No.
Please.
What do you prefer? Is there a model around in the Middle East?
There's only one really true democracy in the Middle East today, and that's Israel.
Yes?
That's a democracy.
Ladies and gentlemen, Dr. Ibrahim has 5 minutes to conclude because he has to catch a service car. So,
why do we have to subject ourselves to the service car? I signed something to that car.
Well, he'll be here at 7 o'clock.
So what? If there are more questions, I'd be glad to answer them. There's a very interesting...
In reference to your forgiveness of debt, sir, I have never heard that Kuwait reimbursed us for bailing them out of Saddam Hussein attacked about 20 years ago. They could well afford to pay your debts off. Saudi Arabia could well afford to pay your debts off. I think they should reimburse us every year for protecting their oil fields.
Agree.
But isn't your argument ultimately that you actually would like to see the U.S. actually have a hand towards pushing, influencing democracy in the region? Remember, he talked about conditional debt forgiveness, right? which in that case would allow the U.S. to encourage. Would you rather have Saudi Arabia holding that debt over Egypt? Your concern is that they're going to go to an Islamist country, and you're asking a Salafist Islamic country to actually control the debt of Egypt. So think about that.
I fully agree with you from your analysis. And you don't want to forgive the debt. What can I say? You are the creditor. I just appeal to you, but you don't seem to be generous enough to do it. That's fine. I'll accept that.
And Egypt's withdrawing.
Finish, please.
Excuse me, what interests me from the beginning of the talk, and it's interesting from the beginning of the revolution, especially with the media, is this word, democracy. I mean, it's thrown around as though the Egyptian people and the people in Tunisia and the other Middle East countries have some concept of Jeffersonian democracy, and that's what they're striving for. I don't know, maybe you do, I don't know what they are all about. For instance, in Libya, I mean, this business about the rebels, nobody knows what these countries are going to be trying to replace their dictatorships with. And the only thing that I'd like to maybe know the answer, I don't, but the word democracy is thrown around as though every rebel in Egypt is seeking a democratic society like we have. I don't think so. And especially if it's Sharia. Sharia is not democracy the way we see it, the way most people perceive it in the West. But I that's something I don't understand. And as far as elections are concerned, there was an article I read just recently. This business about having elections and pushing for elections so fast, it doesn't always work. It didn't work in Gaza. And I would just remind everybody here, as though they didn't know it, you know, Germany elected Hitler. Mm-hmm. He was elected democratically as a chancellor. He got 33% of the vote. It was a democratic election. So it doesn't always work just because people are being elected. It depends on who the people are. And I don't think, as Westerners, we know enough about the people. You know the people, but I don't, and most people in this room don't know who the people are, and people in the United States don't know. And in the West, they don't know who's behind all of this. What are the goals? And that's something I don't know if you're able to answer that. I don't think you are. Nobody really knows. What are the goals?
All right,
let
the goals?
Let them answer.
I often encounter an argument in the White House. When I gave the percentage of the Muslim brothers in the population, some of the people who wanted stability in the White House and the State Department came with an argument which is in line with what you just said about the Nazi being elected. Said, you know, there was the Bolsheviks, they were not a majority when the revolution started in February 1917. But by October, they managed to jump on that revolution and to take it over. So they were worried that this may happen with the Muslim Brothers, even though they are not the majority, even though they came late, and that could very well happen. Not by democratic voting, but by manipulation. If they raise 20% support to 30%, and the others are fragmented, secular forces are fragmented, they may be able actually to have sway in the scene. So all scenarios are possible. And if we are going to have panic scenarios, I can think of three or four myself. And however, as an activist, and that's why I'm going back to Egypt, to fight my battle. I have no excuse if I don't go back and find like-minded and work for democracy as I understand it. Jeffersonian democracy, fine. Fabian democracy, fine. Any democracy, so long as not one man rule at the top, I'll be happy. Pluralism, fine. If the Muslim brothers want to compete democratically, that is a right as citizens. I cannot deny them that right. Just like you don't deny even the Ku Klux Klan the right to vote, the right to organize. I cannot veto any group. It is my responsibility to work hard enough to expand my own liberal, democratic, secular constituency. That's all what I can do. And there are people like myself, and if we don't know, if we cannot work together, if we cannot at least stop the doomsday scenario from happening, we have no excuse. As an activist, that is my duty. As a Democrat, it is my obligation. As a human being, it is imperative that I try to the last breath of my life. That's all I can do. And there are many people like that in Egypt. They may not be as organized, they may not be as well-funded as the Muslim Brothers, but that is why I appeal to you to work on the debt question. And where is Bob?
I knew you were going to ask again for the
to help me, because what I am trying to do actually, my sixth agenda, is to use the monitoring of the election with something like, how many thousand was that?
We're looking, I think, for
50,000?
What's the question?
30,000 monitors is what we're trying to actually train so that they can be at sites throughout Egypt to ensure that there will indeed, I mean, I would say that that would actually be a very, very important agenda item that this group could actually work on. So this is the best way to actually fight if your concerns, and I share those precise concerns, that the Brotherhood is going to make inroads, support this idea of training election monitors, right, and do proactively seek to prevent the Muslim Brotherhood from gaining, or whatever it is, just make sure that it's a fair election. Your concern is that they'll steal it.
Well, it's in that case, it's not just the vote, it's everything leading up to the vote. And
well, that's what we're trying to do.
Yes.
Those 30,000 monitors will be the seeds.
In other words, the monitoring the entire campaign.
For peace and democracy.
The best thing that you could do would be to delay the election.
Your car is here.
I know it is here. I don't care if it is here. I'll take my own car. I'll hire one. I want to answer these gentlemen and these ladies.
The best option would be for the...
Yes, sir.
There was a way of saying by Joseph Stalin where he says, I'm not so concerned about the campaigning. What I'm really concerned about is who counts the votes. And
absolutely.
My thought is this. There are a few things I'd like to say. I think most people can see the benefit of democracy. Democracy means where it's honesty, where people can go into business with their own capitalistic free market enterprise and make money, rather than having somebody in the government take a bribe for this and take a bribe for that, and an enormous corruption that seems to be pervasive in a dictatorship or a semi-dictatorship.
Right.
The point is this. I think I really hope that the Egyptian people can have some sort of democracy that's represented with their values towards an improvement of the society, towards honesty, towards better treatment of other people. Mm-hmm. However, that would be my goal, that they can elevate themselves to greater economic wealth and prosperity. But I do think that there are certain forces against it. In other words,
we're running out of time.
Okay,
it's his presentation.
Okay, I just wanted to say, there was a song very popular, the most popular song in Egypt was called "I Hate Israel." This was a popular song for more than a year. It was the most popular song in Egypt. I think that when that, in other words, the question is, how can the prosperity How can the honesty of the people, in other words, of the government, how can you bring that into fruition when there are so many forces against it?
I'm counting on the young people who stage the revolution, and all of them are modern minded. The guy who triggered it works for Google, and who is this kind of technologically minded youngster. 4 years ago, before him, it was a young lady by the name of Asma, and she's actually coming to the US. If you want to invite her to talk to you, she started this whole thing 4 years ago. It was Wael who escalated the movement from just a protest movement to a revolution. So two youngsters using Twitter, Google, Facebook, and with that kind of mentality, if you have a modern mentality, I don't worry about Qaradawi or Hindawi or X or Y or Z.
Why do you not worry about Qaradawi? There's a million
people. I don't.
Why not?
What do you mean? He came to Tahrir Square. He did not create that crowd. That crowd was there. He took advantage of it.
Well, that was my understanding.
Sure. My wife took advantage of it.
My understanding was that.
Why didn't you mention my wife? My wife and Qaradawi, they were at two ends of the square.